Support for this episode of Fright Day is brought to you by Studio. Elegant audio products with studio quality sound and minimalistic design. Shop now at studiosweden.com. It is Fright Day. I'm Byron McCoy, and this week we're doing something a little different. Since I am currently in Austin, Texas at South by Southwest, scoping out the Midnighter premieres, surviving on breakfast tacos and 3 hours of nightly slumber, you're going to hear something that took several months of research and production to pull off. Audio that only a handful of folks have heard until now. This is Side A of the Roswell Incident, a Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracy special presentation. So gas up the car, GPS your nearest desert, and let's get this show on the road.
Ahoy, mateys. This is a big night, guys. I really hope that the cabin fellas are ready to pitch in and do their part tonight.
Sam's not here. He's late.
He's late?
There he is.
Hey, wait. Okay, all right, I'm here.
I need to give you guys a backstory tonight. This is a pretty big deal. Way back in the 80s, when I was but a wee captain in training, I was assigned my first research paper at the Junior Naval Academy.
What's that? You were always a captain?
Yes. I was at the Junior Naval Academy.
Okay.
And I was assigned my first research paper. Anyhow, we were allowed to pick as our topic any event in U.S. history. My brain started racing like, God, what do I want to do? I mean, I didn't know a lot about U.S. history at that point, but I was combing through the things I did know.
There were some presidents maybe, and there was a war? Or was
the Trail of Tears I remember learning about around this time, and it was pretty brutal and really fascinating. I'm like, maybe I'll do Trail of Tears. And then I was like, no. Underground Railroad was really cool, and
yeah,
I liked the stories about like the Big Dipper and Little Dipper tied to it. I really liked stars. And then I realized that nothing could possibly compare with the history that I was learning on Coast to Coast, on nights in my dad's art studio when I couldn't sleep. So obviously, I had to write about Roswell. Not only is it the coolest story ever, but my dad was actually born 25 days after the crash. This might actually be the root of why I think I'm an alien.
Because everyone knows 25 days after.
Well, it's the gestation period for Pleiadians.
Okay.
So.
Anyhow.
This was quite literally my very first foray into ufology or paranormal research or high strangeness of any kind. And because this is such a landmark case in the history of ufology and the seed that started my journey as a captain, I've done possibly an unhealthy amount of research for this episode.
Are you doing a silent cry?
I mean, no, I'm really happy.
She has no
tears
left.
I didn't learn this much to get either of my degrees. That's for damn sure. I know more about Roswell than I know about English literature or political science at this point, for shizzle.
Something went wrong in your life.
Well,
I can tell you that.
Well, I'm sure everybody knows about Roswell, except for maybe you two cabin fellas. So for you guys, I'm going to give like a 4-sentence synopsis before we dive into detail. In a nutshell, something happened in early July 1947 in southern New Mexico. Some people say it was a UFO crash. Some people said there were alien bodies recovered. The government said it was a weather balloon.
Oh, this is that thing around Corona.
Then 50 years later, because people doubted the weather balloon story, the government said it was a fancier weather balloon. When people said that didn't explain the bodies, they said, oh yeah, there were crash test dummies. Obviously, we'll go into a lot more detail about all of this. But yes, Sam, to your point, the impact site is actually believed to be closer to Corona, New Mexico. So you will hear this referred to as the Corona crash, sometimes the Socorro crash, which is dumb because it wasn't near Socorro, but we'll get into that. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as the Roswell crash. All of those mean the same thing. Few clarifying points. There were a minimum of 2, possibly 3 different sites from the same craft, in my opinion. A point that a lot of people didn't understand until further down the road. If you guys go into this timeline knowing that, you're going to be in a much better place.
3 sites where there were some indication that...
Yeah, it appears to have exploded in the air and scattered quite a ways. Believe it or not, the story of Roswell starts about a week and a half before the Roswell crash itself. It's June 24th, 1947. There's a private pilot by the name of Kenneth Arnold. I really wanted to make a Hey Arnold joke, but...
You couldn't figure out one, huh?
I was going to say...
Something about Stoop Kid?
Hey Kenneth Arnold? Stoop Kid?
All right.
All right. He's in the Cascade Mountains in Washington State. He's flying a Model A plane to Yakima, 2:15 in the afternoon. Suddenly, he sees a chain of what appear to be Chinese kites leaving the face of Mount Rainier. After they traveled for a moment, he began to realize it was actually 9 separate objects that were flying in reverse echelon formation.
You know, what is echelon formation?
Echelon. Sam, would you like to explain echelon formation?
Side to side with increasing elevation as you go?
Yes. The interesting thing is it was reversed. So whatever way the normal echelon formation is, if it's either decreasing as it goes out or increasing, this was the opposite. These objects began tilting slightly and reflecting intense light through Arnold's windshield. He thought they must be fighter jets because they were going so quickly, and he actually, using his fancy watch with a second hand, which was a big deal back then, guys, he clocked the time that it took them to get from Mount Rainier to Mount Adams to determine what their speed was. Basically, the whole sighting lasted maybe 3 minutes. The most important thing is when he landed, he told people immediately what he had seen. So it wasn't as though this is a story that came out like 50 years later. And there's actually an interview with a radio station from the day after, which we're going to play right now.
Newscaster in every newspaper across the nation has made headlines out of it. And this afternoon, we are honored indeed to have here in our studio this man, Kenneth Arnold, who we believe may be able to give us a first-hand account and give you the same on what happened. Kenneth, first of all, if you'll move up here to the microphone just a little closer, we'll ask you to just tell in your own fashion, as you told us last night in your hotel room and again this morning, what you were doing there and how this entire thing started. Go ahead, Kenneth.
Well, at about 2:15, I took off from Chehalis, Washington, en route to Yakima. And, of course, every time that any of us fly over the country near Mount Rainier, we spend an hour or two in search of the Marine plane that's never been found that they believe is in the snow someplace southwest of that particular area. That area is located at about, or its elevation is about 10,000 foot. And I had made one sweep in close to Mount Rainier and down one of the canyons and was dragging it for any types of objects that might prove to be the Marine ship. And as I come out of the canyon there, it was about 15 minutes. I was approximately 25 to 28 miles from Mount Rainier. I climbed back up to 9,200 feet, and I noticed to the left of me a chain which looked to me like the tail of a Chinese kite, kind of weaving and going at a terrific speed across the face of Mount Rainier. I at first thought they were geese because it flew like geese, but it was going so fast that I immediately changed my mind and decided it was a bunch of new jet planes in formation. They seemed to flip and flash in the sun just like a mirror. And in fact, I happened to be at an angle from the sun that seemed to hit the tops of these peculiar-looking things in such a way that it almost blinded you when you looked at them through your plexiglass windshield. Well, it was about 1 minute to three when I started clocking them on my sweep second-hand clock, and as I kept looking at them, I kept looking for their tails. They didn't have any tails. I thought, well, maybe something's wrong with my eyes. And I turned the plane around and opens the window and looks out the window, and sure enough, I couldn't find any tails on them. And the whole observation of these particular ships didn't last more than about 2.5 minutes. And I could see them only plainly when they seemed to tip their wing or whatever it was, and the sun flashed on them. They looked something like a pie plate that was cut in half with a sort of a convex triangle in the rear. Now, I thought, well, that maybe they're jet planes with just the tails painted green or brown or something, and didn't think too much of it, but kept on watching them. They didn't fly in a conventional formation that's taught in our Army. They seemed to kind of weave in and out right above the mountaintop. And I would say that they even went down into the canyons in several instances, probably 100 feet. But I could see them against the snow, of course, on Mount Rainier, and against the snow on Mount Adams as they were flashing, and against a high ridge that happens to lay in between Mount Rainier and Mount Adams. But when I observed the tail end of the last one passing Mount Adams, and I was at an angle near Mount Rainier from it, But I looked at my watch, and it showed 1 minute and 42 seconds. Well, I still thought, well, that's pretty fast, and I didn't stop to think what the distance was between the two mountains. Well, I landed at Yakima, Washington, and Al Baxter was there to greet me, and he told me, I guess I better change my brand. But he kind of gave me a mysterious sort of a look that maybe I had seen something he didn't know. And, well, I just kind of forgot it then till I got down at Pendleton, and I began looking at my map and taking measurements on it. And the best calculation I could figure out, now even in spite of error, would be around 1,200 miles an hour, because making the distance from Mount Rainier to Mount Adams, in we'll say approximately 2 minutes, it's almost, it'd be around 25 miles per minute. Now, allowing for error, we can give them 3 minutes or 4 minutes to make it, and they're still going more than 800 miles an hour, and to my knowledge, there isn't anything that I read about outside of some of the German rockets that would go that fast. These were flying in more or less a level, constant altitude. They weren't going up and they weren't going down. They were just simply flying straight and level, and I laughed when I told the pilots at Fenton, I said, they sure must have had a tailwind, but it didn't seem to help me much. But to the best of my knowledge and the best of my description, that is what I actually saw, and like I told the Associated Press, I'd be glad to confirm it with my hands on a Bible, because I did see it, and whether it has anything to do with our Army or our intelligence or whether it has to do with some foreign country, I don't know. But I did see it, and I did clock it, and I just happened to be in a beautiful position to do it, and it's just as much a mystery to me as it is to everyone else who's been calling me the last 24 hours wondering what it was.
Kelly, if you could come up a bit closer to the mic.
I just love old-timey radio interviews. Arnold's sighting was partially corroborated by a prospector named Fred Johnson on Mount Adams. He actually wrote Army Air Force intelligence to say that he saw six of the objects on June 24th at the same time as Arnold. Within 2 weeks of the sighting, there were other very similar sightings in Tulsa, Seattle, Phoenix, even a United flight crew over Idaho. Due to time limits, we obviously can't go into all of these, but we'll have suggested reading in the show notes of this episode at patreon.com/frightday. So here's the scene. Obviously, there's quite a bit of turmoil in 1947 in America surrounding the possibility of Soviet advanced aircraft or even aircraft from another planet that's flying in our airspace. It's also post-World War II. Patriotism is at an all-time high. Allegiance to the U.S. government, respect for it, and belief in it was at a level that we probably can't even imagine today. Just important to keep this setting in mind as we proceed through our timeline, because some of the things seem a little bit unreasonable that people would either listen to or accept. And you hear the complaint a lot of times that, well, not this many people could have kept a secret. But the reality is people did what the government said back in the day.
We trusted our government.
They just won a war. We were real happy about it. Moving from the Pacific Northwest to the great American Southwest, we're now on Tuesday, July 1st, 1947. There are three different military facilities that are picking up a strange object on radar over southern New Mexico. Two of these facilities are Roswell Army Airfield and Alamogordo Airfield. They're using old school World War II radar. Sam, can you give us a bit of a weapons authenticity about what kind of radar was used during World War II?
Sam's Weapons Authenticity Report.
So the funny thing about radar is it's really... really, 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 really complicated.
Oh, interesting.
It was very crude, but not as crude as the very early radar.
You'd gather up a big gaggle of bats.
Makes sense.
And then you'd have them all do...
What is a group of bats called? I'm pretty sure it's not a gaggle. It's not a murder. I wish it was a murder, but those are crows.
I don't know.
It's not a flamboyance because those are flamingos.
It's a colony.
Disappointing.
Like an alien colony. Okay. The third site that was picking up the strange object was the White Sands Missile Range, which at that point was known as...
Would you be happier if it was called a cloud of bats?
Yeah, that actually is way more fun.
Or a camp of bats?
Those are both more fun.
Yeah.
White Sands Missile Range. Sam, they were using a somewhat newer and more sophisticated form of radar that at the time was top secret. Can you give us any insight into that?
Again, this is my research on radar, which is way over my head. That generation of radar would have been much more capable of detecting both smaller objects and giving more precise readings on their vector and location.
Oh, very good. And the reason they had this fancy radar at the White Sands Missile Range is because they were tracking V-2 rocket launches, specifically V-2 Hermes B-1 rocket launches. Sam, before we go any further, can you tell us a little bit about the B-1?
So the Hermes program itself, from what I can gather, it was a joint partnership between the military and General Electric.
Well, this is a good foundation to lay. So you're telling me that the military commonly works with contractors that are non-governmental. This will come back later in the episode. It's important.
During the fall of fall as in collapse of the Third Reich when von Braun was captured along with a bunch of his buddies.
Oh, Werner von Braun?
Yes.
Okay, well, we got to remember him too. Keep going.
The German rocketeer.
Yes.
Not the flying guy, but makes rockets. Yes. The Allies, specifically the U.S., scooped up parts for a bunch of V2 unguided missiles or quasi-guided missiles that were unassembled and at the factory, and they bundled them all up, shipped them back on 300 train cars to White Sands, and began experimenting with them. The Hermes program was an effort to use the V2 as a first stage to develop a ramjet cruise missile. Basically, what that means, a ramjet operates by once a craft achieves a suitable speed, the air that is literally rammed into the intakes and combusts when it's mixed with fuel, and it's this kind of a self-sustaining operation. But to get there, you have to have a first stage that accelerates the vessel to that terminal velocity, which I think was like Mach 3.3 or something of that nature. It was the first attempt at making a missile that would be capable of reaching around the world, which has obvious implications for national security for decades to come.
Ultimately aiming to get nuclear weapons to reach around the world.
I think absolutely.
Everybody hold on to that thought. Now, all three of these facilities are seeing the same weird thing jumping around, but they don't know that the other facilities are tracking it. The important thing is that for all three facilities, they're seeing the same behavior, which is these weird, inexplicable maneuvers, including reversing direction in mid-flight, right angle turns, climbing straight up or down at immense speeds, sudden stops, and even hovering in place.
Sounds like my Uber driver in L.A.
Oh, my God. Next day, Wednesday, July 2nd, 9:50 p.m., Mr. and Mrs. Dan Wilmot see an oval object, quote, like two inverted saucers faced mouth to mouth, end quote, passing over their house in Roswell, New Mexico. The object, moving at a high rate of speed, is heading northwest. Now, it's Thursday, July 3rd. Roswell Army Airfield decides to send a technician to White Sands because this object keeps showing up, and they're trying to confirm that White Sands is seeing the same thing and that there's not something goofy with their radar. He observes and overhears among staff that their readings are similar to that of Roswell Army Airfield's readings. Checks between the sites continue to substantiate that there's no malfunction of equipment and there are no inconsistencies. There's been no change over about 24 hours, and he finally decides that he's actually ordered to head back to Roswell. All of the facilities continue to track it, but it has been verified that there's no malfunction of equipment. By piecing together records, and keep in mind, everything going on at White Sands at this point was super top secret. It's not just crazy people piecing together records, but that was the way things were because they're trying to keep everything under wraps. It appears that the radar system at White Sands was fully up and running on the 3rd for another reason. They had planned a launch of the modified V2 rocket, the B1 Hermes vehicle that Sam was just talking about. You see, they'd recently been experimenting with this rocket and had quite a bit of trouble. On June 29th, 1947, a launch of the same rocket went horribly awry. Wires were physically crossed in the guidance system, which resulted in a trajectory for the rocket that was almost 180 degrees opposite the intended direction. So that's pretty far off course. And it's when it landed,
of course,
big steel container full of flammable blow up stuff.
Sure was. When it landed, it left a 25 meter deep, 35 meter wide crater over the border in Mexico. So we've got an international event on our hands.
That's somebody else's problem.
Records indicate that there was at least one more and as many as four more failed rocket tests of this same rocket.
They were wildly unstable.
In early summer of 1947. So wildly unstable is pretty bad. 180 degrees in the wrong direction is like, why are you even using it?
But basically, they had like, hey, someone did the heavy lifting for us and designed this rocket. Let's just nail some pallets and open up some beer cans and stretch them out to make little wings.
Hank Hill out there with it.
Yeah.
Maybe you're referencing the movie Twister, too.
So
they took beer cans and made their spinning fans on the top.
All right, guys, we don't have time to get off track. I told you this is important.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
An important side note here. White Sands happened to have been the location where the very first nuclear bomb ever was tested. As you've heard from me before, there's quite a history of UFO activity around weapons facilities and specifically nuclear weapon facilities. It's possible that the strange craft seen darting around southern New Mexico on radar was actually a series of UFOs that were there to foil the military's efforts to develop this new weapon that could possibly make nuclear weapons even more damaging than they already were. The records of the planned V2 Hermes B1 launch on July 3rd are fuzzy at best, but they seem to point to another failed launch. It's possible that this one even resulted in an explosion and two casualties at the launch pad. Sources also claim that the rocket, after launching improperly, pancaked violently into the desert near Magdalena on the plains of San Agustin. Now, for you Rozzies out there, you hardcore ones, you will recognize this location is a very problematic location that some people argue an entirely second UFO crashed. After my research, I've come to the conclusion that evidence points towards a rocket crash at this location, not a second UFO. And it's either pure coincidence that it happened near the same time as the Roswell incident, or it's because the UFO had something to do with this failed launch, one or the other. This crashed rocket occurred on the 3rd, which explains also a lot of inconsistencies with the first major phase of Roswell investigation in the 1980s. This heap of twisted metal in the middle of the desert that was almost 200 miles west of the more well-known site really most likely was just a V2 Hermes B1 crash. And it could also be why some people reported seeing military on this site over at the plains of San Augustine. A number of years later, there was this guy named Grady Barnett. And though he didn't talk about it with any ufologists during his lifetime, his friends came forward after his death. He was a soil conservation engineer for the federal government, and apparently during the 4th of July weekend, specifically on July 3rd, Barnett came across what he described to his friends as a crashed disc in the course of his work on the flats, which was right by the plains of San Augustine. All of Barnett's accounts are secondhand, but they record the description as something flattened metallic with a diameter of about 20 feet. This sounds a whole lot like a flattened, failed V2 Hermes B1 rocket. So ranch owners Jack Bruton and his wife, who also have a ranch in this neck of the woods, heard whatever it was come down and they went to investigate, and they also described it as this giant hunk of metal. They thought it was possibly a piece of an airplane. They discussed nothing about bodies, nothing about anything extraterrestrial looking, not even anything flying saucer-like, which as we know was all over the news at this point because of the sightings across the country. Barnett reported that while he was at the scene, military personnel showed up. It would make sense that the White Sands folks were tracking the rocket and went over to try and clean up any more damage that they'd caused, because this was apparently the way things went with the Hermes B1.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not a Warner Brothers cartoon. Things don't hit the ground at high velocity and just go...
Keep in mind, it could definitely create something that looked like a disc-ish shape, and it's going to be a giant hunk of metal that's twisted up in the middle of the desert. I think it makes a lot of sense that this is the V2 rocket. This isn't a second UFO crash. All the records that I've read about arguments that people like to make for a whole second UFO crashing, I don't buy it. We got a V2 rocket on our hands, guys. End of story. Now, the real crash. Friday, July 4th. Two Catholic nuns that night, reported to be Mother Superior Mary Bernadette and a Sister Capistrano, see something amazing out of the 3rd floor window of St. Mary's Hospital. They record this sighting in their logbook and discuss it with their colleagues. It's described as a bright, fiery object in the sky that appeared to go to the ground northwest of Roswell. Years later, Dan Wilmot, who we mentioned earlier as seeing saucers mouth to mouth flying over his house on July 2nd, he came forward and said that he too had seen a flash of light in the sky in the same direction around the same time that could have been an explosion. He was hesitant to come forward during the time of the actual incident because he didn't want to be mocked for seeing a flying saucer again. Apparently, they caught some flack for the July 2nd sighting. This same time frame, there's a thunderstorm near Corona, New Mexico, and Mac Brazel, the foreman of a ranch belonging to the twin Foster brothers, hears a tremendous thunderclap that sounds like an explosion, but somehow different from the rest of the thunder. He's not the only person that reports this. Other people in the area report the same sound. Simultaneously, the military is following this object that's been running around for the last couple of days. It appears to divide, separate, and then disappear at exactly 11:27 that night, so it's assumed that this was the exact time of the crash.
Interesting.
Yeah. Thanks to the close radar tracking, the military gets to the site pretty darn quickly, but they were not the only people headed there. At the same time, a professor of archaeology named W. Curry Holden and some of his students are on site somewhere west of Roswell when they observe an object fall to the ground not far from their camp. They're in agreement that the object was definitely an aircraft. They're worried about the crew, but it's too dark and there's a storm, so they don't feel like they can go explore and be of any use. So they nominate one student to go to the nearest town of Capitan to report the crash to Sheriff Wilcox in Roswell, because he's the closest one. But they weren't responsible. They reported it to the authorities. Because of the darkness and impending storm, they make the decision to try to both locate and find out what it was the following morning. Same exact time frame, a gentleman named William Woody and his father watch a flying object, white with a red tail, fall toward the ground north of Roswell. Another gentleman, Jim Ragsdale, and his lady Trudy Truelove, It's an actual name, guys.
Are you sure it's a real name?
Yeah. They see a bright flash of light and hear a roaring sound that passes overhead. Ragsdale knows that something has struck the ground close to their campsite and mansplains it to Trudy.
Mansplains it?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Every time a man explains something isn't necessarily
Can you see a scenario where a gentleman named Jim Ragsdale...
Mansplaining is where somebody explains in a very, very condescending tone. Usually it's a man explaining it to a woman who doesn't understand something.
Kelly, listen to Sam.
Sheriff Wilcox immediately calls the volunteer fire department, thinking that there may be some injured people. One volunteer fireman named Dan Dwyer, possibly with a few fellow firemen and police officers, head on their own to the crash site, not in an official capacity. When they get there, they're held by military police before they can get within eyeshot of the actual site. The military authorities guarding the border most likely don't know what the heck is going on themselves, so they decide to let the fire crew stay at the checkpoint in case they're needed at the scene at some point that evening. At this point, it's midnight, so we're crossing over into July 5th. Dan Dwyer is quoted as saying that he saw the first pink lines of sunlight over the horizon.
That's beautiful.
Poetic.
It's basically there at least through the pre-dawn hours. He also noted there was an extremely strong glow showing up, not from a fire, but from something similar to the way that lights illuminate the dark sky during a football game. In other words, we got a lot of floodlights, folks. Before sunup, Dwyer concocts a plan with his buddies who distract the military police with coffee from their thermos to share. Meanwhile, Dwyer sneaks away undetected, crawls up some rocks, looks over the ridge, and is able to see something quite strange.
You guys, they're back and the same as ever, which is great because that's what they've always been. This episode is brought to you by Studio. And we all know hearing, also known as auditory perception, is the ability to perceive sound by detecting vibration, changes in pressure of the surrounding medium through time, through an organ such as the ear. You're doing this with my voice right now, and it's possible you're being assisted by headphones. Of course, they can privatize your listening experience, and personally, I don't blame you. The government is definitely paying attention. But why not look cool while experiencing premium quality audio of often conspiratorial content? Or whatever you want to listen to. Studio is the solution for you. Studio has now sent us each a pair of their Tray model Bluetooth earbuds, and I have to say, they're quickly becoming more than earbuds. They're ear pals. We're borderline best friends. The Tray sound signature is well balanced, with each tone represented clearly for an even listening experience. They also offer something called full sound transparency, meaning a user, like myself, can still hear my surroundings without having to remove my earphones. That way, I can hear what people shopping next to me at the grocery store think of my tired edit eyes. Studio wants to revolutionize the way people see headphones, not just as a tech device, but also as an accessory. Currently, the headphone market can only offer you one of two things, style or tech. Fashionable headphones tend to lack proper sound quality, and high-tech variations are bulky and not design-oriented. Studio has bridged that gap. And right now, you can use the promo code FRIGHTDAY15 to save 15% at studio.com. Make sure to click the link in this episode's description to let them know that we sent you. And thank you so much, Studio, for your support. Now, back to the show.
He sees uniformed military personnel, a series of turned-on floodlights, and various pieces of equipment such as Jeeps, SRC 399 radio rigs, and other communication vans. Center of all this activity is a strange aircraft, which is being lifted into the air by a crane. He watches as it is set on a flatbed truck and covered with a tarp and chains. Because none of the firefighters or police officers with him saw the same thing he did, they all were sticking back to do the distraction thing.
Those thermoses.
Yeah, he's the only witness from that crew. The military recovery team works through the night. Very early the next morning, just as the sun begins to rise, some civilians show up on the scene. These civilians were described by some of the military police guards who later came forward, and this corroborates the story that W. Curry Holden and his crew of students arrived at that very same time. Soldiers are told by their superiors to escort these civilians out of the area. This also triggers the officers to set up a much larger cordoned area rather than just the dirt roads that are leading to the site.
Because the riffraff was wandering in.
Specifically these students who were just trying to check out what they saw the previous night, trying to make sure everybody's okay, which they weren't.
If you see something, say nothing.
Well, exactly. And they were all sworn to silence. The military wraps up this first phase of cleanup, moving all the major wreckage out, because they are at this point unaware that there is a second debris field on the Foster Ranch. They pretty much believe they've successfully contained the event. They're probably patting themselves on the back. Interesting point about W. Curry Holden. Though he kept quiet most of his life, reports are that he did speak about this event towards the end of his life. There are some hard facts, though, lending themselves to believe something happened. $5,000 was a lot of ducats back in 1947. And this gentleman, Holden, made a deposit of almost $5,000 to his bank account on July 15th, 1947. Also interesting, ufologist Kevin Randall looked into all of Holden's income tax records for every year from the 30s through the 70s, except for one year. You guys want to bet which year that was missing?
Want to guess or bet? Are we betting?
Well, both. It was 1947, guys. It was 1947.
47. Mm-hmm. That's what I would have said.
Holden also never published any research connected to what he may have been doing that week in the Roswell Desert with the students. But this would make perfect sense if he was scared and sworn to secrecy. His best course of action, at least I would imagine if I were in his shoes, would be remove himself from any history of the scene altogether. So he doesn't want anything that would connect him to that location at that time. I mean, I'd forego a research paper for that.
And you said $5,000?
$5,000. That's more than you'd get from any... Ooh, I don't know. You want to do a conversion for me?
I have it right here.
Oh, you have it? What is it?
$56,146.98.
So like if I just came back after one weekend and made a deposit of 50 some thousand dollars into the bank, I guarantee you there'd be something strange going on, guys.
Yeah, it's a lot of money.
So we're going to skip over to the Foster Ranch debris field. Following the rain the night before, Mac Brazel wakes up and inspects the pastures surrounding the ranch house. Riding with him, as he so often did, is the young son of his nearest neighbor, the Proctors. This young kid, by the name of William D. Proctor, more commonly referred to as D-E-E. During the inspection, Brazel and D discover a large debris field. Scattered on the slopes and into the sinkhole and depressions are metal, plastic-like beams, pieces of lightweight material, and foil. The debris is thick enough that the sheep refuse to cross the field and are driven around it to water more than a mile away. Now, this is one of those kind of fun sensationalist bits. Some reports have said that the sheep were scared of the material and wouldn't go near it. Really, based on what I was able to read, it sounds like it was just too thick for them to walk across.
I mean, sheep are scared of a lot of stuff, though.
Mostly just wolves.
No, really? they're dumb. They're scared of everything.
No, they're spooked of most
they're
things.
They're dumb. They're nice.
They're soft.
Brazel, taking a few scraps of material, headed over to the Proctor's house. He and Dee showed them a little sliver of the material that they could neither burn nor cut. The Proctor suggested that he took it into town and showed it to the sheriff. And at this point, Brazel's like, maybe, maybe not. So rumors are he did go into town that evening, or at least some point that day, and he learned that there was actually a $3,000 reward for evidence of a flying saucer. Again, this is because of the recent craze about flying saucers around the country, and recent as in the like past couple of weeks. There's $1,000 offered from two separate newspapers in addition to $1,000 from an unnamed private citizen. Not only is $3,000 a ton of money at this point,
$33,000,
he's also dirt broke, so this really piques his interest. Later that evening, Brazel removes the large circular piece of debris from the range. He either loads it into his truck or drags it behind him, stores it in a livestock shed about 3 miles north of the crash site.
Do you think D was riding on it as he drug it behind
him? I mean, maybe. I
like
think
a strange saucer?
It could be.
Saucer
it was a saucer. That's I mean, it was a saucer sled. Yeah.
Spray it with the newest super slick lubricant. And
yeah.
I just think about how hot it was trying to collect that debris in the July
you
heat.
Mean debris.
I love debris. Back to Roswell, guys. Gentleman named Johnny.
Are you sure you don't want to talk about you, me, and Dupree some
I mean,
more?
I mean, if we could get him on the show, I'd be totally great with. Yeah.
Okay.
Big fan. Back in Roswell, Johnny McBoyle, a reporter from radio station KSWS in Roswell, he runs into Mac Brazel as he's in town, apparently also learning about this $3,000 reward. Brazel tells McBoyle the story, and McBoyle decides he better go find the touchdown site and make a story out of it. He later makes a call from 40 miles north of Roswell, which is near the primary crash site, to Lydia Sleppy at his sister station in Albuquerque. Sleppy tries to get what McBoyle was telling her by phone onto the AP wire, whereupon the transmission is halted mid-sentence by the FBI, who orders her to abandon the transmission. Really? Pretty creepy, huh?
Wait, how's a wire transmission work?
I don't know. It was the 40s. Sam, do you know how a wire transmission worked?
It was like super sciencey.
I would do that away from the mic.
Yeah.
Nope. Also at this primary crash site, there's a gentleman named Sergeant Brown, who was just a cook on the base and was grabbed to help guard the site along with everyone else on base during this emergency. Years later, he told his kids about seeing a crash disk in the desert. He told the story for the first time when they were watching the moon landing. As he relayed the story, he was told to climb into the back of a truck to watch something that was in the truck. It was under a tarp, and he was obviously told not to look under the tarp, but as soon as no one was watching, he did what all of us would do, and he looked under the tarp. What he described were strange-looking bodies, 3 to 4 feet tall, very skinny, big heads, friendly faces.
Oh, what?
He told this to his kids, so I don't know if he was just trying to keep his daughters from being scared, but he said they were friendly faces. Yeah,
he's telling the story, and one of them starts to do lip quiver, and he looks up at his wife, and she's
no,
like,
friendly faces, honey. Faces. Yeah. Reflection of the green tarp made them look somewhat yellow, and he was quite certain they weren't human. Another interesting thing, shortly after this event, he actually received a promotion. The promotion material specifically referenced his assistance during the peculiar circumstances around Roswell. So we got some evidence mountain. An evidence mountain mountain.
A mountain of evidence mounting?
Yes. July 6th, Sunday. Mac Brazel gets up early, completes his chores on the ranch, and drives into Roswell about 75 miles away because he's going to get this reward. Brazel stops at the office of Sheriff George Wilcox. Wilcox is pretty excited about the find. For some reason, some reports have him saying that he was pissed off about it, but actually he was really excited. And he suggests they contact the Roswell Army Airfield. Sometime later that morning, Frank Joyce, a second reporter and announcer for a second radio station, this one is KGFL, he calls the sheriff, which I imagine was commonplace in this day and age and location.
Prank phone call.
No, he goes, hey, anything interesting happening that I can do a story on?
Anything at all, because it's New Mexico.
And so Wilcox obviously says, hey, you got to talk to Brazel. We got a hell of a story here, buddy.
Well, and this was a bit of a sleepy town.
Real sleepy.
20,000 people at the time.
I know it's more than doubled in size since then.
It sure has.
Yeah. Everybody went there to work at Dulce. All right. This same time, Glenn Dennis, a 22-year-old mortician working at the Ballard Funeral Home in Roswell, receives a strange call from the Roswell base. It's the mortuary officer who asks him how many small/child-sized caskets they have on hand. Kind of a weird question.
I'm trying to plan for the future, and I'm just inquiring about how many child-sized, caskets the size of, say, a child.
Maybe child coffins are cheaper and you can just bend their knees up.
The mortuary officer calls again a little bit later, this time asking Dennis questions about what various chemicals would do to blood and tissue. He also wants to know the procedures for preparing a body that's laid out in the elements. At this point, Dennis decides it's probably a fatal crash involving some sort of very important person. This same time frame, the rogue police officers and firefighters, including Dan Dwyer, return from the primary crash site. They're tired, they're dirty, they're a little bit angry that they never got to see the site itself. And according to some stories, the firefighters go to the, volunteer firefighter house and pass around some debris that's been commandeered. It's unclear whether this happened early in the day or a few days later. However, Dwyer's daughter remembers how the material felt and also remembers a conversation that came shortly thereafter that scared her a great deal.
So it made the circle of all the firemen that were standing around the table, and everybody did what they wanted to do, and it was laying there, and I reached over and I picked it up. I sat there and played with it for a while, just wadding it up and dropping it. And when I was holding it in my hand, I couldn't feel it in my hand.
And then she says a few days later, there's a military guy that came by and basically told her,
you didn't see anything. You were not there. And he said, if you ever say one word about this the rest of your life, we will split up this family. If that's not enough, he said, it's a big desert out here. We can take you out in the desert. And he said, no one will ever find your bodies.
Back to the primary crash and body site, William Woody and his father, who, if you remember, saw something crash the night before, they decide they're going to drive towards the area where they had seen the object come down because William Woody's dad believed it was a meteorite and they were going meteorite hunting. However, the side roads off Highway 285 from Vaughan and to the west were all guarded by military police who allowed no one to pass. The meteorite expedition was totally foiled.
Foiled?
Yeah. All right. I didn't even mean to do that.
Are you sure?
I'm positive. Later in the day, Glenn Dennis receives a call from downtown Roswell where an airman had been injured. Now, the funeral home where he works also operates the ambulance service for the area. So he drives the injured airman to the base. He's waved through the gate, stops at the rear of the hospital, parks behind it. And at the loading dock in front of the emergency room, he sees three ambulances. In the back of them, he sees small canoe-like devices, which people have interpreted as being the lead bags that were holding the bodies at this point. And he also sees some strange debris of some sort. Now, quick aside, you guys, I did a little bit of research on the reliability of eyewitness accounts, on how much people lie, because let me tell you, so many of these stories I had to cut out because it turns out that the person told a lie down the road or part of what they were saying had been exaggerated. And these are a couple things I learned. First off, everyone lies.
Everyone?
Men lie an average of twice as frequently as women.
Oh, man.
Men lie an average of 6 times a day. Women lie an average of 3 times a day.
Wow, we're all terrible people.
Yeah. And
I was right.
The other thing is, when it comes to eyewitness testimony, the people who are most certain about their testimony when giving it are also the most correct, you know, with the highest frequency. But they're only correct with the highest frequency if you take their initial testimony. Because what happens, even people that are honest by nature will hear after their first testimony other people's corroborating testimonies. And some of those details, absent of their will to do so, will bleed into their own story. Mm-hmm. So it's really important when you're dealing with anything eyewitness related that you get as much information as you can initially before they talk to anyone else. And that's really what you try to ride on. Now, it obviously gets a little complicated when it comes to the Roswell stuff because people were scared to talk about it. But when they finally did come forward, as Glenn Dennis did in the late 70s, early 80s, it's really important that we go with kind of that first report that he gave. And in that first report, he talks about seeing the wreckage. Now, down the road, some ufologists say that he also reported seeing bodies, but he did not say that in the initial record.
And that's not a detail you usually leave out.
I mean, keep in mind, all of the testimony that was given was a minimum of 30 years, in most cases, 50 years after the fact. Because this wasn't a big deal at the time. It was buried really quickly and it went away. Can you imagine trying to remember 30 years ago what you did on a difference of 1 or 2 days?
Well, I can't because I am 30 and I was...
Okay, well, you know what I mean. I can't even remember 2 years ago what I would have been doing on July 3rd versus July 4th.
Yeah, but something got smashed into the ground.
Right. But my point is, you'll hear me bring this theme up commonly, which is go with your first report. It's kind of like when you're taking a standardized test, go with your first answer.
See.
Yeah.
The whole time.
Well, no, that's not true.
Works
they
time.
Work really hard
I'm
to avoid that.
Right.
Okay.
I try to write words.
Inside the base hospital at Roswell, Dennis is confronted by two officers. A red-haired captain tells Dennis that he has seen nothing and heard nothing. If he opens his mouth, they'll be picking his bones up out of the sand. Dennis was a 22-year-old spunky young fella, and he kept saying, "I'm a civilian. You can't do anything to me." But then when the general or officer said that, he got real scared.
Oh, we're the military. Yes, we can.
Right, exactly. So he also ran into a nurse friend of his who apparently had just come out of an autopsy room. She looks very frightened, and she tells him to get the heck off the base right away.
Mm-hmm. Did she look ill as well?
She was sick to her stomach. There was some horrible smell.
Yeah.
Back to Roswell Army Airfield. Colonel William Blanchard, who's the commanding officer at the airfield. Now, remember I told you guys the first ever atomic weapon was tested at White Sands?
Mm-hmm. Is it the Trinity tests?
It was. Here's the other thing, though. Not only do we have that piece of nuclear war history in this area, but the 509th Bomb Group, who dropped the bombs on Japan, is stationed at Roswell Army Airfield. This is dead center for nuclear death. Like, this is where the scariest nuclear things have been linked. And Blanchard is obviously a respected military gentleman because he is entrusted with the oversight of this first and only atomic bomb strike force in the world. It's a pretty big job. It's important to remember that. Now, he orders Jesse Marcel, the air intelligence officer, to investigate. Marcel immediately drives to the sheriff's office and interviews Mac Brazel. He examines the pieces of the material that Brazel brought in and decides he had better visit the ranch to examine the field for himself. But first, he wants to show the material to Blanchard. So he takes some of the debris with him, heads back to the base, reports to Blanchard what he has seen, shows him what he's got. Blanchard is also convinced that he's in possession of something highly unusual. Blanchard immediately worries that it could be Soviet. So he alerts the next higher headquarters, and then Marcel and Blanchard all confirm that this was definitely not anything they were familiar with. Which means, guys, it wasn't a damn weather balloon. The guy in charge of overseeing the only atomic bomb strike force in the world can tell what a weather balloon looks like. So even if you want to say Marcel wasn't high enough up, which he was, and he wasn't an idiot. But even if you want to make that argument, Blanchard sure as hell wasn't. Marcel returns to the sheriff's office with the senior counterintelligence agent assigned to the base. His name is Captain Sheridan Cavett. They escort Brazel back to his ranch to examine the debris field. Back at the base, Blanchard is ordered by Major General Clements McMullen, who is the deputy commander of the Strategic Air Command. Sam, you want to tell us a little bit about the Strategic Air Command?
Sure. Strategic Air Command was formed after World War II to direct two of the delivery vectors, I guess, of our nation's nuclear, our nation being America, nuclear arsenal. It was responsible for strategic bombers and missiles, the third being submarines they were not responsible for. So they had nuclear-armed bombers circling the Arctic, ready to go at a moment's notice, missiles pointed at Russia.
So scary.
Until it was disbanded following the fall of the Soviet Union.
Wow. Obviously, people are taking this stuff pretty seriously because the fella running that whole shazam, he orders Blanchard to locate more of the debris and send it in a courier pouch on an airplane to Fort Worth Army Airfield. And there it's given to Colonel Thomas DeBose, who is going to transport it on to Washington, D.C. Back in New Mexico, we've got Brazel, Marcel, and Cavett. They're driving over rough roads, bumpity bump, bumpity bump, bumpity bump, on the way back to the ranch. And by the time they get there, because the roads are so crappy, it's dark. They stay in the Hines house, which is an old ranch house close to the debris field. And I have no idea why this is such an important detail, but it comes up in literally every account of this story. They eat cold beans. Not sure why that's so important, but it's mentioned everywhere. So there must be some reason. Maybe it's a secret message that the alien recovered was actually Brack.
What?
No.
Here's a lovely song about my favorite food. Lima, lentils, oy, and pinto, navy, northern, and garbanzo, kidneys, and frijoles, negros. I love beans. I love beans. Woo, woo, woo. I love beans. How about you? High in fiber, low in fat.
I thought you didn't want Sam and I to be dumber.
Brack is so much smarter. If Brack were my cabin fella, this ship would be sailing to other planets at this point. Literally. That night, because they can't search the debris field, Marcel at least runs a Geiger counter over the large piece of wreckage that Brazel had stored in the cattle shed, and he detects no sign of radiation. Next morning, Monday, July 7th. The three fellas head out to the debris field, which is roughly 3/4 of a mile long, 200 to 300 feet wide. There's a gouge starting at the northern end. It extends 400 or 500 feet toward the other end, and it looks as if something had touched down and skipped along, which would explain why there's debris here and then the larger crash wreckage further south. The largest piece of debris is recovered at the southern edge of the gouge. Most of the debris recovered is as thin as newsprint, but incredibly strong. There's a foil that, when crumpled, unfolds without a sign of a wrinkle, just like we heard from Dwyer's daughter. Foil. Yep. There are I-beams that flex slightly and have some symbols on them that some people described as hieroglyphs of some sort. There is a possibility that there was a third site for this same crash that was discovered near the debris field. The reason for this, we've got a couple different accounts. First off, as you'll hear in a few minutes, Brazel was detained by the military for 5 days on base starting the next day. If he had only seen debris, it seems very strange that they would do this because a lot of people saw the debris. Additionally, we have conflicting reports about the number of alien bodies that were recovered. And if, as some people say, two alien bodies were found at this spot just a couple miles from the debris field, it would explain that difference in numbers of alien bodies. Mm-hmm. Perhaps the most convincing bit of evidence is, remember Little D. Proctor? Well, as the years went on and researchers started to come and interview people in Roswell, he would literally run away every time they came to town. He wanted nothing to do with it. He refused to talk to anyone about it. And he would make comments to his mom once in a while about a second area where he and Mac found something more. He kept saying, when his mother got older and he thought she was going to die, Dee finally took her out to this place, this second site near the debris field, and explained that this is where Mac had found the bodies. I'm not willing to hang my hat on this third site, but it certainly fits in with a lot of the information that I've researched. So I'm going to say that I'm giving 70% certainty that there is a third site approximately 2 miles from the debris site with two alien bodies. And I believe that as Brazel, Marcel, and Cavett were combing the debris field on Monday, July 7th, they came across these extra bodies. And that's why things escalated to the next level shortly thereafter. Lieutenant Hout, who is the public relations officer at the base, comes back from a 4th of July weekend and immediately learns that someone has reported the remains of a downed vehicle near Roswell. He's also aware that Major Jesse Marcel, head of intelligence, was sent by the base commander to investigate. By late in the afternoon that same day, Hout would learn that additional civilian reports were coming in regarding a second site just north of Roswell. Hout is one of the first people to realize that there are two sites, because at this point, most of the people at one site don't know about the other one. But this is where the information starts to converge. Walt Whitmore, who is Frank Joyce's boss, if you'll recall, at KGFL Radio, says, "Boy, we got a story brewing here." He sends somebody out to grab Brazel at the ranch, bring him back to Roswell so that he can be the first one to get this scoop, and he can help Brazel hide out in Whitmore's home to make sure that nobody else takes him before he gets the story from Brazel. All right. Mm-hmm. Marcel and Cavett are finishing up the debris field recovery, and Brazel comes back to town to do the interview. Meanwhile, Lieutenant General Nathan E. Twining, who's the commander of the Air Material Command, which is the parent organization at Wright Field, Ohio, now known as Wright-Patterson. This would be the next higher headquarters for both the Alamogordo Army Airfield and the Kirtland Army Airfield. He changes his plans from another trip and flies into Alamogordo. He's in the area through the 11th of July, which is proven by flight logs that were obtained by ufologists. Years later, there was an important letter written to this general that came to light, and it gave some valuable information to those believing Roswell was an extraterrestrial incident. Now, listen carefully. This is a bit confusing. There was a document as part of the MJ-12 documents called the Cutler-Twining Memo. Many believe this document to be a hoax, along with the other MJ-12 docs. And while I am still undecided, I will not be using any of the MJ-12 docs in this report, because I am making a great effort to make this report as non-controversial as a Roswell report can possibly be.
But if you're into more majestic 12 information, you can go back and listen to Captain Kelly's Cryptid Conspiracies episode 3.
Love it.
Way back there.
Now, a lot of people don't know of the undeniably real Twining letter that was sent in September of 1947. It was essentially in response to a collection of reports of flying saucer sightings, similar to and including the Arnold sighting in Washington that we discussed at the beginning of the episode. Twining's response to that collection of reports was as follows. We'll read some excerpts of it. The full letter, of course, will be in the show notes of this episode at patreon.com/Friday. Mm-hmm. It is the opinion that the phenomenon is something real and not visionary or fictitious. There are objects probably approximating the shape of a disc of such appreciable size as to appear to be as large as a man-made aircraft. The reported operating characteristics, such as extreme rates of climb, maneuverability, particularly in roll, and motion, which must be considered evasive when sighted or contacted by friendly aircraft and radar, lend belief to the possibility that some of the objects are controlled either manually, automatically, or remotely. Now, if it was believed that what crashed at Roswell was Project Mogul, right, this secret weather balloon project, mm-hmm. there is no way that Twining would have made the recommendation at the end of this report that further investigation of these type of phenomena was required. I do need to point out that he doesn't refer to Roswell specifically in the memo at any point. It's more of a reaction to the collective events that have happened earlier on in 1947. I think it's just important to note that he obviously thought something was going on. He was recommending that they investigate it further, and he wouldn't have been doing that if it was a top secret government project that they were trying to cover up. Back to Roswell, Walt Whitmore Sr., remember, he's our radio show operator. Mm-hmm. He asks Brazel to stay the night in Roswell at his home, and he brings in a couple more of his partners. That evening, the station's minority owner and newsman, Judd Roberts, conducts a wire-recorded interview with Brazel. By the time they're done, KGFL is off air for the evening, so the broadcast would have to wait until the morning.
They didn't even broadcast 24 hours?
No!
They didn't have a nighttime DJ spinning all the hits?
I don't know. It was also Roswell. At this point, Marcel and Cavett are headed back from the Brazel
compound.
Yeah, I guess it's actually the Foster compound, though everybody does that. But yeah, it's the Foster Ranch with Brazel. It's between 12 a.m. and 2 a.m. on Tuesday, July 8th. And at this time, Marcel decides he's going to stop by his home and show some of this crazy debris to his family. This is what Jesse Jr. would later recollect. He awakens the wife and the son And he's getting around the idea that it's okay to do this because he says it hasn't officially been declared top secret yet. Mm-hmm. So before it is, that's why he stops there on the way back to the base, because once it's declared top secret, he knows he can't let any info out.
And it's also fun to wake up your family.
Well, and to say, look at this. Check this out. This is pretty cool. Oh, my gosh. Sam, if you came home to show us this in the middle of the night, I'd be pretty excited.
I wouldn't be excited about anything in the middle of the night. That's when I sleep. Don't wake me up. I don't care if it's aliens.
He also tells them that this is unlike anything they'll ever see again. Big deal. 6 a.m. Marcel and Cabot visit with Blanchard in his quarters on base and tell him what they've seen. Blanchard calls the provost marshal and orders him to post guards on the roads around the debris field. Armed guards encircled the primary areas, denying access to anyone without official business. Again, if all they were holding was balloon debris, they would not do this.
This was a top secret project, though.
If it was Mogul, maybe, but we'll hear further as to why it definitely couldn't be Mogul. First off, none of them recognize any of the material. The regular 8 a.m. staff meeting is bumped up to 7:30 and is attended by all of the super high-level officers on base. In addition, we have Brigadier General Roger Ramey and his chief of staff, Colonel Thomas J. DeBose. The main topic of discussion was reported by Marcel and Cabot regarding an extensive debris field in Lincoln County, approximately 75 miles northwest of Roswell, ACA, the Foster Ranch debris field. A preliminary briefing was provided by Blanchard about the second site approximately 40 miles north of town, ACA, the body and disc site. Samples of wreckage were passed around the table. It was unlike any material that anyone had ever seen in their life.
Wouldn't it be fun to use it as origami paper?
It would be very frustrating because it would always like pop right back out. You'd never get anywhere.
It'd be a zen
exercise.
Like the mandala things where they just wipe away.
Yeah, whatever that is.
Yeah, no, I don't like that. I like permanence. Now, this is coming directly from Hout, public relations officer, and he gave a sworn affidavit towards the end of his life. Pieces which resembled metal foil, paper thin yet extremely strong, and pieces with unusual markings along the length were handed from man to man, each voicing their opinion. No one was able to identify it. Again, even if this was Project Mogul, which was top secret, certainly General Ramey would be able to identify it. I mean, this is crazy. One of the main concerns discussed at the meeting, according to Hout, was whether they should go public or not with the discovery. Ramey proposed a plan, which Hout believed actually originated from his bosses at the Pentagon. Attention needed to be diverted from the more important site north of town, because that's where the bodies and the big disc were, to the debris field because there was less scandalous material there. Too many civilians were already involved and the press had already been informed, so they couldn't just disavow knowledge altogether. Hout wasn't really sure how they were going to do this, but obviously he's a lesser ranking officer. He's just going along with it. Back in the city, Whitmore, now that his wire-recorded interview is complete, takes Brazel to the military base because they have contacted Brazel and told him that they need him to come out there so he can take the military police out to the debris field and show them where they need to set up and block things off. Very quickly thereafter, Whitmore receives a phone call from the FCC in Washington. He's told not to air the interview with Mac Brazel. If he does, the station will lose its broadcast license. Later, Senator Dennis Chavez, chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, phoned Whitmore, strongly advising the same.
You have reached the end of side A of this cassette. Turn the tape over to continue.
And for access to side B of this special presentation of Captain Kelly's Cryptids and Conspiracies, 16 more episodes of our series, and 3 other exclusive programs, including mine, Byron's Serial Corner, where we talk lesser-known cases of truly terrible people, visit patreon.com/frightday. If you are really feeling this or have a craving for physical media, pick up the Roswell Incident on limited edition fluorescent green cassette tape at shop.frightday.com. This version includes liner notes by Kelly as well as a digital download code. The art is great. It's fun to hold and look at, maybe even play in your parents' or grandparents' car. It's kind of my favorite thing. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'll be back next week with more HARP and our thoughts on Alex Garland's Annihilation. That is, if I make it home.